Wagwan, everybody. Welcome to the Dis Afemi History Podcast, where we'll be speaking about history and as well family history and how history relates in terms of Caribbean people for the present as well as in the past, and how in the past, what that does and brings forth for what we are going through at present and what we can learn from our history, from our family, and take that moving forward. So I do hope you enjoy the podcast. And if you like it, please ensure to subscribe, like, and review. Thank you.
In today's episode featuring genealogist and researcher Emma Cox, who has been researching her family history for over 25 years. We'll be diving into how to interpret Old English writing in British Caribbean. So let's have a listen.
Thank you so much, Emma, for coming on to the podcast, Dis Afemi History. We're going to be discussing about Old English handwriting in the British Caribbean, and we're going to be looking at some documents that are from different file sources types. So whether it's just on FamilySearch, through the Jamaican Archives, or through as well through the Endangered Project. So before we start, we'll have you just do a brief introduction of yourself, and then we'll start.
Thank you so much for inviting me on here today, Wendy. It's great to be able to see you and speak with you and go through some fascinating old documents. My name's Emma Cox. I'm based in England, and I act as a family researcher historian. I also have my own podcast, Journeys into Genealogy. I've been doing this, and I find it absolutely fascinating, for probably about 30 years myself. I'm sure everyone will agree that genealogy is addictive once you get started, and the more you get into it, the more you want to learn. So I have clients everywhere, all across the world. I help them with doing family trees, with getting past brick walls, interpreting documents, actually transcribing documents, all sorts of different things. And I love it. So that's a very brief introduction.
Oh, no. Thank you so much for that. That's fabulous. So we'll get into it. So yes, this basically the premise of this discussion at the moment is in regards to, you know, interpreting these old English documents. And of course, they're written in a time, because these are around the 1800s, they're written in Old English. So basically words that are today's time, like the letter C, is sometimes written as a letter S type of thing. And you're trying to scratch your head going, okay, what is this word, mash or marsh or whatever it's supposed to be, right? So it's one of those things that when you get to a certain point in your research, you're going to be coming across some of these documents and just trying to understand what is the language. Even though it is written in English, it does seem like it's a foreign language. And of course, it's in scriptive language. So, and of course, I just find it is very beautiful to look at. It's kind of like artwork at first, and you're like, what am I reading? And then you're like, oh, this is very nice, very pretty. So we'll look at a couple of examples and take it from there. But I think, first of all, how would you say for someone to, once they come to looking at a document, how can they kind of prepare themselves for reading such a document?
Okay, so with any document that you have, you need to think about, where did it come from? First off, sort of, is it the original? That's really important. Is it a copy of something? And that's, we'll touch on that in a few minutes. What the content is, it something like a template that's been pre-printed that somebody has to complete? Or is it something that someone's written out completely by hand? What's the style of handwriting that's in there? Are there words that are used every single time, and there's only a few words that you need to actually understand, which are normally things like the people's names, the dates, the places, and a few more bits and pieces like that. So when you're looking at documents, you need to sort of assess them. And I always find it quite helpful to actually have a couple of screens open on the computer if I'm doing it on the computer, so I can go back and forth. You can transcribe them. I use a really good free transcription tool, and I'll have to try and find the name of it in a moment. But you can basically put the image in the top half, and then you type directly into the bottom half, and it scrolls the screen as you do it. So you can go through and actually transcribe what you're doing then and there. And that is sometimes very helpful when you're looking at older documents.
No, that's great. And I'll even put the transcription in the show notes as well, so people can be able to use that as well. So we'll get started and get into one of those documents. So first, if we can look at the intestate record, meaning this is someone that died without a will. And of course, it's, as you said, it's already almost pre-formatted. So let's bring up that record.
Okay, I'll share my screen. This is on my screen. So just to say that this is a document that came from the archives in Jamaica. Wendy actually went to the archives and took this photograph, and it's of the original ledger. So this is a really important factor. So you have got primary source here, so that you know what has been written here hasn't been copied by somebody and the words have been slightly misinterpreted in some way. It's also part of a format, so yeah, the people are given places to actually fill in the relevant information that is only relevant to the particular person that it's talking about. So in this particular instance, we have a letters of administration. So I'm just going to sort of start with the top and the bottom. Yes. So it says His Excellency Edward Trelawney Esquire. So you've got EDW being short for Edward, mm-hmm. Captain General and the Governor of the island. And so right down at the bottom, you've actually got his signature. So you know that you've got the governor actually writing this letter of administration and signing off on it. So you know it's actually been agreed that somebody has actually said that this is correct. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you do find things that might not have the right signatures on, or they might be empty in some way. So this has actually gone through and it's been approved. Taking it from the top left, we can see we've got Jamaica, and then underneath that we've got Marsh William. So we've got his surname first and his Christian name second. So just to actually make that clear, sometimes it can be quite confusing if you have names that could be either. Mm-hmm. So you just need to work out which is the person's name there. So His Excellency Edward Trelawney Esquire, in chief and over His Majesty's Island of Jamaica and other territories, thereon depending in America, ordinary and sole judge for the probate of wills and granting letters of administration. To all whom these presents shall come, greetings. Know ye that whereas, and that was all pre-printed, apart yes. from the person's name at the beginning, and then we actually have some beautiful old script saying William Marsh, late of the parish of Kingston, mariner, so we're being told what his trade is here, mm-hmm. is declared intestate, and whereas Peter Fennell of the parish of Kingston, Esquire, as principal creditor to the said deceased, hath this day, and then there's some lines through it just to fill out the blank spaces there. So what we're being told here is that William Marsh is dead. He has died without a will, but one of his creditors has come forward and says, okay, well, I want the money I'm owed. Mm-hmm. And so I am stepping forward and I'm going to be the administrator for this one. So that's great. And after this, it says that Peter Fennell appeared before me and requested to have administration of all and singular the goods and chattels, rights and credits of the said William Marsh, administration, therefore, of all and singular the goods and chattels, rights and credits of the said William Marsh, is by me, Edward Trelawney Esquire, in chief, ordinary and sole judge, as aforesaid, granted and committed to the said Peter Fennell, having before me taken an oath well and truly to administer all and singular the goods and chattels, rights and credits of the said William Marsh, according to law, to make and cause to be made a true inventory of all and singular the goods and chattels, rights and credits of the said William Marsh, and the same return into the Secretary's office of this island within 6 months after the date hereof, and also to give a just and true account of this administration, whereon thereunto lawfully requested and having sworn that he know nothing of any will of the said William Marsh by him in his lifetime made. So basically, William Marsh is intestate. Peter Fennell is saying that he knows he's intestate, that he hasn't had another will that he's found or anyone else has found, and that he has agreed to put together the letters of administrations and the actual inventory of everything that he owned. So that could be land, that could be property, it could be things within your property, it could be books, clothing, it could be crops, it could be absolutely anything. And he's legally agreeing to within 6 months to come back with a true inventory of his property. And I imagine at that point, he will then say how much was owed and if there's any money left over, what would then happen with that? So given under my hand and seal at St. Jago de la Vega, the first day of August, Anno Domini 1745. So this dates all the way back to 1745, this document.
No, and it was quite a document to kind of come across and to read, because it's, I probably read it at least a couple of times to kind of get all of the information, because you can see that some of the letterings is kind of different, even though it's predetermined to kind of infer whether it's an F or an S or those types of things.
And sort of like for 6 months, that's quite an elaborate S on the front and the beginning of the 6 months there. And with these things, you do get things like Edward Trelawney is EDW, but it's not never written in full, but you know that's what it stands for. And it's when you start reading these documents over and again, you would know that who that person was and how they commonly wrote their name and that you've got the correct person and things like that.
No, definitely, because again, it's, you never think that you would ever come across something like this in terms of intestate, because we think that, you know, things that happened within our lifetime is, you know, the first and ever time that ever happens, as opposed to something from a document from 1747 that you're going to see. But this is where it all comes from in terms of our own current laws. And then I guess...
Have you actually done any follow-up, just an aside? Did this actually happen? Did you find the letter of inventory or the anything like that?
This one, no, I was not able to find the letter of inventory. So I'm still kind of, this is still kind of an outstanding one for me to kind of go back and still find, because again, unfortunately, a lot of the documents, even though they're supposed to be in the archives, especially in Jamaica, they aren't. They are found elsewhere, unfortunately. So it's probably one of these things, because I've come across something else where I'm supposed to find it in the archives, and it was somewhere else in the United States. So I'm assuming I will probably find it somewhere else. But I think this connects to a mystery that another family has in the United States, where this William Marsh connects to as well.
I think one of this is it's a breadcrumb. It's leading you on a trail somewhere else, isn't it? You've got this, so you know that this happened. What's next?
Exactly. Because I, in terms of the immediate family connection to the Marsh, I could not connect this particular one. But again, it's, as you said, it's one of those breadcrumbs.
And it doesn't mention anything about his family or anything like that. So all you have is literally the fact that he was a mariner. So you could potentially look up any records relating to ships in those days to see if there were any that were in his name, or also look up the creditor himself and see what he traded in and what he, William Marsh is likely to have owed him for.
Yes.
That could be shipbuilding, it could be trading in goods, it could be property, it could be all sorts of different things and other clues within that.
Oh, no, definitely. These are all definitely clues to use for other things and to take you down another path. So,
yes, one of many.
And the other document that we have is for one of a manumission. And this one is part of the Endangered Archives Project.
Okay.
And I think this was originally started by the
not to that one, show you that one from the start there.
Perfect.
So as Wendy has said, this is a manumission, which is basically setting somebody free from being enslaved. So this is completely handwritten document. This one dates from 1756. I've actually zoomed in slightly more on the next one, so I'll just move across to that one. So this is basically saying, in Jamaica, it's the name, in the name of Cook and wife to Baker, in registered 26th of June, 1756. And it's beautifully written, and there's lots of lovely little curly bits on the D's and things in there. D is a particularly good letter in this one. Know all men by these present that I, William Cook, and Anne, his wife, of the parish of Westonmore Pond in the island aforesaid, tavern keeper. So you know what his business is with this, and the fact that he and his wife are there are named. for and in consideration of the sum of £26 of current money of the island aforesaid, or one new Negro girl to the value of the said sum above mentioned to them in hand, will well and truly freed by Robert Baker of the parish and island aforesaid bookkeeper. So you've got the occupations of both parties mentioned with this. Have manumised and forever set free, and by these present, the said William Cook and Anne, his wife, their heirs, executors, and administrators, manumise and forever absolutely set free one mulatto slave named Fanny, with her future, I think that says son, is that right?
Yes.
That word, son, and increase, reported daughter, so I'm believing that means she's pregnant.
Yes.
Increase, so let's get to that line again, of the said Robert Baker, and born of the body of our Negro slave named Bess, and of and from all and all manner of slavery and servitude whatsoever, in witness whereof the said William Cook and Anne his wife have hereunto set their hands and seal this 15 days of June in the year of our Lord 1756, signed, sealed, and dated in the presence of Richard Littleboy, Peter Frederick Callam, I think that says.
Yes.
Yeah, and so William Cook and Anne Cook. Not sure that they've actually signed this. This doesn't look like there's particular signatures to me, because this looks like it's actually written in the same hand as actually written the document itself. Received the day and a year above mentioned in full consideration above mentioned of Mr. Robert Barker, as witness our hands being £26 of current money of the island aforesaid, and again William Cook is written there, being present Peter Frederick Callam personally appeared before this 16th day of June 1756, William Cook and Anne his wife, and made oath upon the holy evangelist that they did sign and seal and deliver the is that witness? That last
where within?
The within instrument of writing as their act and deed of the said Anne Cook being privately examined by me, and did acknowledge that she did sign the within instrument of writing without any compulsion from her said husband. And that's been witnessed by somebody called A. Crawford. And then that goes on to somebody else, doesn't it? The next one, there's someone else there. So I've read that out, and I've hesitated with reading certain words there, because it's not easy to read all of it. And it's trying to, I think one of the tips I would give you when reading something like this is try to read lots of them. And the more that you read, the more that things will become familiar to you. You will understand the writing of the person. You'll understand the layout of it. So I can imagine that in this particular instance, there would be quite a lot that would be the same in this one and subsequent ones. Obviously, the names are different, possibly the amount of money, the dates, and the people themselves. Excuse me. It's a beautifully written document. It's not a particularly easy one to read, given the subject matter. A very important document, and I hope that this person actually did manage to lead a happy life once she was freed from slavery, with her child and her to-be-born child as well.
No, definitely. As you said, it's an important document, and it's one that's a heavy document in terms of reading and knowing the importance, the fact that this person was going to be set free, and they were very, as you were reading, very particular in what they were saying, in the sense that she was free, and of course her heirs were free, and her future children were free, right? So, because in slavery, is if the mother was enslaved, the children were enslaved as well. So that was their automatic designation in that time frame period, but definitely that's why the language of the document is written the way that it is, and they keep, even though it's repetitive a little bit, but it's written a specific way because of what was happening during that time and the fact that she was going to be free as well as her children.
And the fact that when she was freed, it was due to a payment of money and not
Yes.
to another person being enslaved.
Exactly. Exactly. So all of that is, and as you said, it's you're reading many of these documents to kind of get an, I guess, a familiarity in terms of the how it's written. Because some of these are, depending on who is the writer, it can be a lot more elaborate and makes it a lot more challenging to actually read the documents. So no, this is it's just one of those things. And of course, mentioning the money, the time, and of course the date and who is there to witness, because sometimes those witnesses, you'll see them come up somewhere else because they're part of their small collective. Because that's one thing that I've realized is that they may be a witness to a wedding or to a death or mentioned somewhere else along the lines, right? So
I would
those are
want to
names to kind of keep
investigate
you.
those people more
Yes.
and just find out more about everybody who actually was a party to that, and how much was £26 actually worth? Where did this take place? If there's any more information on that, what life was like in Jamaica at the time? Who was William Cook? Who was his wife? Where was their inn based? If there was any
Yes.
information there, what would a slave have been expected to do when they were working for them as an innkeeper? So, cook, maybe a cook, or somebody working in a bar, I don't know. Or maybe it was, if it's an inn, is it a hotel as well? So people staying there. So there's lots of questions that
Yes.
actually come up as a result of actually reading this one.
No, absolutely. And of course, when you mentioned about the money, there is the difference. Once you start reading some of these documents, not just the manumission, is that it will indicate in terms of £26 of currency of the island or £26 sterling, meaning that it's the equivalent to England's money at that time. So there is a massive difference in terms of what that value really does mean. But no, it's, as I said, these are just very interesting documents, and the information that you can glean from these is just it's just amazing.
And just on that note about money there, it will be interesting to look at the other documents within this and see, well, she is a female slave who is a child and is pregnant. Is that why she is £26? Are there other people in her position who are a similar, are people more, are people less? And sort of how does this everything work? And so, yes, lots more questions there.
Yes, definitely. When you're reading these documents, it tends to, you end up having more questions more than anything else. You're excited to find it, but yes, it definitely reveals, and that's a very good point, in terms of what does that mean exactly, right? So, just one of those things. And then now we'll go to the third document, which is the, I think it's the marriage.
Actually, I'm just going to go to that on the screen here because I think I've got
Okay.
that in another window. I want to just start at the top of this page because we've actually got different records on this document here. These are marriage records from Jamaica, which are available on FamilySearch. If you don't already have a FamilySearch account, you can set one up for free. And then if you start looking, you can find lots of information about Jamaica upon there. I actually did a search because Wendy very kindly sent this through to me, but I also thought I'll try and find it myself. And so you can see the results of the search. I'm just going to move myself out the way. On the right-hand side, I looked for Elizabeth Falconer with a husband of Charles Mills. And I originally started looking in the parish of Guy's Hills, assuming that it was the same. And it was not until I re-looked at it again and I thought, this is actually a completely different location, this first record, to this second record, which is the one that we're going to discuss today. So it's really important when you're looking at things not to make an assumption that what starts a page continues further down.
Very good point.
And a very good point. A second point I just want to make here is it says here duplicate of the original register of marriages. So basically, somebody has taken the time to copy and in beautiful handwriting, which is actually very easy to read in this instance, which is really good for us when we come to look at it a couple of hundred years later or whenever it was actually taken. But it's a duplicate. So when you have a duplicate of document, it's, for example, you have parish records and you have bishop's transcripts in records in England. And basically the parish record was completed by the curate or the vicar or the local parish priest. And the bishop's transcript could be completed by them, but it could be completed by somebody else. And it might take less information. It might have more information. It is a copy, but not necessarily an absolute copy. And this says a duplicate of the original register, but we're never sure without seeing the original whether it contains exactly the same information. So please do bear that in mind whenever you're looking at something. Is it the original source document like we looked at with the letters of administration, which came straight from that ledger, which was accessed in the archive? Or is this something that's been transcribed online or copied or something like that? So this one is a duplicate, a nice duplicate, but it is duplicate. So we are looking, let's just zoom in slightly, the duplicate original register of marriages solemnised by ministers of the Wesleyan Methodist denomination at Beech and Hill in the parish of Metcalfe in the Guise Hill and Westonville circuit. So we have number 26, and when married was the 1st of August 1850. The names and surnames are Charles Mills and Elizabeth Falconer. Ages are both full age, so that means they're generally 21 and above. Condition, so basically have they been married before or not? In this case, they're a bachelor and a spinster. It might say widowed, it might say widower, something like that. But it might even be blank. Rank or profession, you've got carpenter. Now, it looks to me like there's a little ditto mark underneath that. And this is where I think that the person who did that actually made a little mistake there. Not a significant one, because you wouldn't necessarily expect a woman to be a carpenter, certainly not in 1850. But just to note that that's there. So St. Thomas of the Vale is their residence at the time of marriage, and they're both living there, and it's after banns. So with banns, it means that you had to proclaim for 3 Sundays in a row that you were going to get married and give somebody the chance to actually object. I don't know if people ever did. I've not really heard of anybody doing that. But basically, it also gives you a chance to actually prepare for a marriage, and it means it wasn't done in a rush. Sometimes if it was to say in there it was done by license, it would mean that somebody probably was actually wealthier, because licenses cost money, and you could get it done quite quickly. People in the aristocracy and things like that actually tended to marry by license in England, because they sometimes wanted to get married quickly, or they wanted to do it without other people necessarily knowing about it. When you're having bans, it's public information. Anybody can see that you've done that. Also, it says consent by whom given. So if either of these people were underage, somebody would have to consent on their behalf, generally a parent, a father, a mother, more generally a father. But in this case, this isn't actually necessary because they're both of full age. And it says they were married at Buckenhill Chapel by me, John Mearns, minister. This marriage was solemnised between us, Charles Mills and Elizabeth Falconer. So you see, you haven't written her name in full there, but it is in full in the register above. And in this case, they've both got their marks. So this means that they were illiterate, so they didn't know how to write. So we know that they're probably at the time, education levels, I'm not sure what they were in Jamaica just at that time, but these people made their mark. And we have 2 witnesses in the presence of Alexander Luck. I'd have to look into that a little bit more and just see how that related to the other letters on the page. It's not a G. It could be an S, that first letter there. Yeah. And then Alexander Gilzine. Now, we also have a little pencil mark on the right-hand side, which is rather intriguing. Mm-hmm. And that looks to me like it says Alex Melcham, possibly, or something like that. And again, I would want to know why that's been put in there, because that has been done possibly at a different time to doing the original register. Are they something to do with the wedding? Is it somebody who did the transcription? Why would they have put that on there? That's just a little oddity that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see on a page like that.
Exactly.
So, examined with the original register by Jamians and found to be correct. So he's saying that this is a true copy of what was in there. And as I said earlier on, we have a couple of other things on this page here. So we have at the top here, this is Watsonville and elsewhere in the parish of St Anne and Guy's Hill and Watsonville Circuit. Again, these people, Abraham Cunningham and Isabella Rose, got married on the 12th of January 1851, of full age, bachelor spinster. He's a tailor, and they're both of the local parishes there, and they got married after banns. He signed his name in this instance, although what we're seeing on this page is the transcript, so it's not his signature, but on the original register he would have signed it. But his wife, Isabella Rose, is her mark is on there. And in this case, the witnesses both share the same surname as the first person, the groom. So it's likely that they are potentially brothers, fathers, uncles, something like that. And just moving to the third one on this page, this is a duplicate of a register, again in the Wesleyan Methodist denomination of Buchan Hill. And this is number 27, married on the 8th of December, 1850. So you can see that actually the dates seem to jump around a little bit here. Yeah. So we've obviously got the last, first one on the page is the last one of a previous chapel. And then we go into from January, 1851, back to August, 1850. So on the 8th of December, 1850, we have Robert McFarker. Scottish ancestry, yeah. I would say, with that one, and Sarah Robertson. But the rest is completely blank. There is nothing in there. So that could indicate that the person was not able to read the original register and the information that was in there, because it is likely that some of those would have been completed, that they would have had to put their age, whether they're a bachelor or spinster, their rank, and where they were living, and whether it was after bans. But in this case, there's nothing actually on there to indicate that information. Both of these people have put their mark. So again, these people weren't literate. And in the presence of two completely different named people, but of the same name. So we have John Clunes and Joseph Clunes. So it is possible that they might have been related to one or other of those, but they just don't share the same surname there. So we're actually quite fortunate in that we've got three completely different examples of marriage entries on the same marriage register there.
Yeah, and it's really good to note as well that because these were the Wesleyan Methodist denominations, they would be found in the what are called the dissenter records. So yes, marriage, but under the dissenters, so not under the Church of England, where most people would have found in terms of these types of records. And as you mentioned before, I guess earlier when we started, is the fact that these are formatted in this particular way. That in each chart, just to say this, because this is a copy of the original, and that's how it would be. This is how it would appear.
Yeah, and by this time, I think in England they're just about moving on to pre-printed registers, where literally they had to fill in the blanks. Here they've actually done it quite nicely. They've used a ruler and made boxes and things and everything, so it's actually very easy to read, and the person's written it beautifully, and so it's a really good register in terms of the layout and the ease of reading it.
Yeah, no, definitely, because by 1880 in Jamaica, this changes, but it's very similar formatting, but it changes to be more formalized in terms of, and at least then you'll see whoever are the witnesses. It will say the witnesses as well as their father, usually mostly on most records. So, no, this was very good just to be able to go through these different types of records. And before we end off, like, is there anything that you wanted to just give as to kind of advice when people are looking at these types of records?
I would say with all records, you need to think about where it came from. Is it the original? I can't emphasize that enough. Just be careful when you look at something. Look at something once, maybe look at it more than once. If you're finding something difficult to interpret, try reading it. Actually physically reading it out and seeing what the words sound like, because sometimes that's a bit of a clue, because things may be spelt differently now, but they actually, if you say them, they sound exactly the same. Try writing it out, and then try sort of looking at any other information that's similar to see for patterns. If there's words you're struggling with, check the letters that are formed on the same page or similar pages written by the same people, and see if you can understand them if you're struggling with interpreting particular words. And I would say also leave things. leave things for a while and come back to them. Because it's all too easy to just think, oh, I've read everything within that. I know all of that. Oh, I'm never going to understand that. But you might come back to it and all of a sudden something else jumps out at you. You might not have been looking for that. It might have said, okay, well, they had bands then. Well, I maybe need to go and look at something about that. Or if it's a license, is there more information in a different place? Or there could be just another piece of information that jumps out at you. And with all of these things, as you do more of it, the better your eye gets and the more you actually understand about what you're looking at, and you can understand. And it's also worthwhile researching the customs at the time. So what was marriage like at the time, or what does a manumission mean, or if you're going to do letters of administration, what's the process that somebody goes through to actually do that? Because that sort of gives you a bit of understanding of what you're looking at to start with, but also it might make you look at something and say, well, that's not quite what the process is supposed to be. Is there something different here? Why is it different? And it makes you question things. It makes you coming back to something makes you sort of look at it and think, oh yes, I understand that. But you might be looking at something for a different reason. So I sometimes go back and I won't necessarily have taken full notice of the witnesses, for example, on a marriage, but then you go back and think, well, who were those people? And what do you actually want to know about those people? And is it relevant that they're there? And that might give you a whole new understanding of the family. It might open up a new family line. There's all sorts of different information you can find when you go back and look at something more than once.
No, I couldn't agree with you more there, especially with the you read it a couple of times and leave it alone and come back, you know, a couple of weeks later, or maybe even a month later, to kind of make sure what you read is exactly what you read. And I think that's excellent advice to be able to do that.
And a sounding board of somebody else. Yes. Ask somebody else about something, if there's something you don't understand or if there's something you can't read. I've got a friend who's she's actually doing a genealogy course at the moment. She asked me to look at some old documents which are actually 100 200 years older than these ones. And it's like I was going through them and thinking, well, I think it's that. Oh yeah, I hadn't got that word. And it's like, what's that one? And so just the back and forth between us.
Yes,
we managed to sort of see a few other bits, and then you start thinking about logic. Well, what will be the most logical word to fit in that place? What are they talking about? What would be the word that is likely to be within there? And as you said earlier on, a lot of it is repetition, especially if you look at things like wills. The number of wills I've read where it says so and so leading to so and so, and then repeating this previous part, and you're repeating the same thing sort of 10 times, which makes it easy to read in the end. It's a little bit boring, but
but it's just one of those things for us to be able to, as you know, whether family historians or genealogists or researchers, to be able to really dig deep and understand the document that we're looking at. Because again, when you look at it the first time, you're just kind of taken aback and going, oh my gosh, I'm excited. And then of course, reading it and really digesting the information that is there and really understanding it. Yeah.
Can I just make one last point? It's like, don't believe everything you read.
Yes.
Yeah, because people do lie for different reasons. People might say they're full age and you know fully well that they're underage. That happens a lot of times on things. Or people might say they're younger than they are if they're married and the partner is younger than them. Mm-hmm. So the people invest and people's parentage. So fathers could be a stepfather. It could be somebody that they believe is their father. There's all sorts of different things. So just because you can find it in an old document that looks genuine, don't automatically accept it as truth.
Yes. No, I agree. I've definitely seen that where the father has been listed as one person. Then I see another document. It's a totally different father. And then I'm going, okay, what am I reading here?
Yes. Yeah. But make a note of it because there's likely to be a connection of some sort.
Yes.
And then it just, but it's not necessarily what it looks like on that piece of paper.
Yeah. No, yeah. I definitely would agree, because you definitely go down these trails and you just can't believe what you're reading.
And you're reading it and you're thinking, okay, hang on a moment. That's not quite right. Oh, well, really? And then you go back again and
No, absolutely. But no, thank you so much. I do appreciate you coming on and speaking to us about and going over these documents, because honestly, when you start to go down certain, as you mentioned, we've gone through different time frame periods from the middle of 1800 to the middle of 1700s. And you can see the difference and the variance where it's starting to get more, I guess, organized, and less of the old English. But again, just to understand what those patterns look like, and to know, and to that they, you know, some of these records can be found online, but however, there's some that you will have to go to the archives to be able to find. But no, thank you, Emma, and I appreciate the, as I said, again, I appreciate your time to come on and talk. And again, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hoped you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please make sure to like, follow, subscribe, and write a review for the episode wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you.